Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We have some news about a story we aired earlier this year. You might remember hearing about Jim Schaefer, who at 87 is the last handmade commercial brewmaker in West Virginia. Well, the Library of Congress is playing this story in a special screening on Saturday, September 30th. We've posted more information about the event on our website at wvpublic.org. In light of this new development, we're going to revisit our episode that featured James Schaefer. We'll take a visit to his brewmaking workshop in Kanawha County, and we'll also talk with two bakers who are reviving the lost art of salt rising bread. But first, let's hear the next installment of The Struggle to Stay. Thousands of coal miners have lost their jobs since 2011 in Appalachia. The loss of coal mining jobs in Appalachia actually began decades ago with mechanization and as market forces drove businesses to other parts of the world. The question of what will happen to coal miners in the communities that depend on them in Appalachia has become front and center in national discussions. Dave Hathaway is a former coal miner in Greene County, in the very southwestern corner of Pennsylvania. As we heard last week, Dave is an unemployed father of two trying to hold on to his dignity while he stays at home with his new baby and his wife works.
For, I think, the man of the house not to have a job is pretty disheartening. I mean, it's a hit to my ego, really. I mean, Ashley's the breadwinner. I mean, it's cool she has a job, but I mean, I need to chip in.
With family in the region, he and his wife are committed to staying in Greene County, even though the job choices there are thin. So what happens when Dave is offered a job to work out of state for good money? Here's the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier with the next installment.
Dave was still looking for a job. It was coming up on a year since he'd been laid off. He was still on the waiting list for a job at the Cumberland Mine and was getting close to losing his health insurance from his last job. Here's a recording he made at the time.
Doesn't seem like they're hiring anybody anytime soon, so I'm still waiting on that. My money's running out. My wife's probably going crazy. Sure she is.
After starting around number 70, his name was now somewhere around number 20 on the waiting list at Cumberland. Dave had been at Emerald Mine for 8 years, and by the time the mine closed down, he'd secured an above-ground job operating heavy equipment. To him, being above ground was better. For one, it was safer, and he just considered it a higher status job. Dave had plenty of gory stories of people getting injured by rockfalls or close calls he had had as an underground coal miner. One time he thought he might get electrocuted by a faulty wire in a pool of standing water. If he got called back to Cumberland, he knew he'd be back underground. But at least he'd be in Greene County.
I mean, I still don't want to go back underground, but I don't have a job. I mean, it's great money, great insurance, and I need that.
He's determined to stay in Greene County, close to his 11-year-old son, with his wife and now his new baby boy. His wife Ashley is working, but Dave's starting to feel desperate. Dave and Ashley spent the next few months watching the waiting list at Cumberland, and Dave followed up on leads for other jobs. Here's Dave in November 2016.
Well, we have a new president in Donald Trump. What do you think?
He's making this recording while Deacon, his newborn, sits on his knee.
I don't know. He's supposed to bring back jobs, create jobs, and bring back the coal. I mean, I hope it does happen. Realistically, I don't see it happening. I mean, it's probably better for the coal market that Hillary Clinton isn't in there, that's for sure. But I don't know what kind of power Donald Trump has to bring that market back.
You can probably tell from hearing him, Dave isn't entirely enthusiastic about the American political system. Throughout the campaign, he seemed lukewarm on Donald Trump. He called him a wacko, even though Trump was pro-coal. At one point, he said he wouldn't vote for him. But in the end, he did. He was a coal miner, after all, and Trump said he would bring back coal.
Hopefully, he proves himself right, I guess, and brings it back. That would help me and my family out, and hundreds of other families, probably thousands of other families.
Late in 2016, he got a job offer for a company that was doing blasting work. He'd found out about the job when he ran into someone he used to work with at Emerald Mine.
I was walking a dog, and he's driving up this road and stopped, and he's asked me what I've been doing, and that's when I was still cutting grass.
It involved working underground, but it paid really well, $40 an hour. But there was a drawback. He'd have to spend 4 nights in another state, away from his family. The job was in Maryland. It would mean leaving Ashley at home by herself to take care of their newborn son, Deacon.
And it was a day shift, but it was 4 days gone, like I'd be staying in a hotel. I mean, it was kind of hard to pass up, but I mean, we agreed that I pretty much had to do it because I didn't have any funds coming in now. But yeah, I mean, I was dead set on going. I bought, like, I had to go buy a razor for you had to have a clean shaven face. And
but then a few weeks before Christmas, just before he would start his job in Maryland, Dave got word from Ashley that someone from Cumberland's Human Resources office was trying to reach him. He called back and left a voicemail. He had a good idea what the call was about.
So I called back and no answer, left a message, and she called back probably an hour later and told me it's going to be a good Christmas.
Dave was offered a job at Cumberland as a general inside laborer. He accepted. Dave had told me in the months before that he really didn't want to go back underground, but this was his way to stay in Greene County and support his family. If he never had to go underground again, he'd be okay with that. As for Ashley, she said she was used to Dave being underground.
Ashley, how do you feel about him going back underground?
It's a scary job, but that's what I grew up with. Like, my dad and my uncles, they were all coal miners, so I'm kind of used to the fact that it happens, but I wish he could have found something else, but nothing compares to the pay at all. And right now, and the benefits, we were so lucky having our baby this year and still having his insurance because we didn't have to pay a penny. So that was great.
Free baby.
Yeah. Yeah, usually you're paying like $5,000 for a baby.
We got a cheap baby.
Dave would be going back into a mine. There were a lot of questions. Would it be safe? Would the job last? But all those could wait. Dave was home, and he and Ashley could pay their bills. And that was all they could ask for now. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Reed Frazier.
Next week, we'll hear the conclusion to Dave Hathaway's Struggle to Stay story right here on Inside Appalachia. So we just heard a story about a former coal miner who's struggling to find his place as the coal industry continues to decline. The coal industry has certainly changed over the past 100 years, but what about broommaking? As we mentioned earlier, a story we aired about an 87-year-old broommaker is being screened at the Library of Congress later this month in Washington, D.C. Actually, a video we made about Jim Schaefer went viral online, and people from New York to Florida who saw the story decided to come visit James Schaefer to get one of his special handmade brooms. And when we checked up on Jim to see how he's handling all the newfound attention, he said he was surprised that so many people consider him an artist. The way he sees it, this is just a job he's been doing since 1946. Along Davis Creek in Loudoundale, West Virginia, outside of Charleston, there's a long green building on the side of the road with the words Charleston Broom and Mop Co. That's James Schaefer's workshop. He's been making brooms since he was a teenage boy. West Virginia State folklorist Emily Hilliard took a trip out to Jim's shop to learn more about his craft and what makes a good broom.
I arrive at Charleston Broom and Mop on a brisk fall morning and make my way through the storage room, past rolls of straw, walls of tools hanging on pinboards, and dozens of brooms, bundled and stacked in tall rows. I find Jim Schaefer inside his dusty workshop, standing at a machine that helps him attach straw to a broomstick.
Well, I'm James Schaefer. Most people call me Jim. I'm 87 years old, and I'm the owner of Charleston Broom and Mop Company here in Loudondale, only 1 mile short of Kanawha State Forest.
Jim is tall, sporting jeans and suspenders, with a friendly face and big smile. His hands move adeptly around the broomstick, adding straw by the handful. He's done this so long, he doesn't need to measure. He can build a broom by feel. Jim's brooms are the classic straw variety, the image you get in your mind when you think of a broom. They have a wooden handle, natural straw with wire binding the two at the top, and 5 bands of colored thread sewn across the midline of the broom. Often this thread is red, but he also sews them with blue, green, yellow, or white thread. The broom style and the equipment he uses hasn't really changed since Jim first started making them when he was 17.
Well, the change has been in the usage of brooms. Instead of sweeping sidewalks and outside garage areas and everything, they use the gasoline blowers now to blow the dirt and dust away. Same thing in the house with these new laminate floors they have. They're so slick that they've developed dust mops type things for those sweeping the house and things, those that have those floors, and there's, you know, an awful lot of them. So the broom industry is fading out. I suspect another 5 to 7 years you won't find a straw broom in the store.
Today, Jim's main customers are local Lions clubs who buy them and sell them for their annual fundraisers.
If it wasn't for Lions clubs selling brooms as their fundraisers, I wouldn't have a business today. But Walmart, Kmart, and Kroger's have took all that over now, and you don't have any mom-and-pop stores to buy from the wholesale distributors, so they all went out of business.
Jim also sells at Pyle Hardware, a local store that's been operating on Charleston's west side for 84 years, just 3 years younger than Jim himself. Bill Pyle owns a store and says customers even make special trips to Charleston just to buy Jim's brooms.
I mean, he does that out of pride. I mean, when he turns out a broom, he wants it to be just right, and he's proud of it, you know. And skilled craftsmen are just few and far between.
Bill is a third-generation owner of Pyle Hardware. Back when he was a teenager working for his dad, Bill's father sent him to buy brooms from Jim. Bill leads me through the hardware store, past rows of pocket knives, bird feeders, and Dutch ovens, to the broom rack.
There's a 6, there's an 8, and the 8's a little bit bigger. They make a Black Beauty that has black bristles in it. Then they make warehouse and railroad brooms, and they're usually a broom that's made to sweep heavy stuff.
If Jim Schaefer is shopping at a store other than Pyle, he makes sure to check out the broom competition. He judges a store based on the brooms they sell.
The synthetic plastic straw doesn't compare to a natural corn broom at all, the sweeping quality of it.
Along with the natural straw, another feature that makes Jim's brooms unique are the 5 bands of thread he sews across the broom to hold the straw together. This detail factors heavily in Jim's pride in his product, as well as his judgment of other brooms.
Well, you see a lot of them in the store today with 3 bands or so, and I don't approve of that. I don't think I've ever made an order for anyone with 3 bands. I have used 5 and 6. That sewing of the broom makes the durability longer if it's sewn tight enough that it doesn't, in time, flex and come and loose to where it flips instead of sweeps.
So you look down on a 3-band broom?
Well, sure. If whatever product you're into, anybody else don't come up to your standards, you don't approve of it.
As Jim showed off his different broom models, whisk brooms, toy brooms for kids, heavy-duty brooms for industrial projects, and standard household brooms, I noticed an old sign hanging on his wall. Framing a blue graphic of an eagle, red block letters read, NRA Code, Broom Manufacturing, 1934. Jim's quick to tell me that that's not the NRA I might be thinking of, but the National Recovery Administration, part of Roosevelt's New Deal. The NRA set minimum wages and maximum work hours for the broom industry.
Franklin D. Roosevelt, as far as I'm concerned, was the best leader and will always be the best leader that the country's ever had. He recognized all industry.
While Jim may have slowed down, that's not apparent from the tall stacks of brooms lining his workshop. When Jim's gone, though, it isn't clear how the broom-making tradition will continue in West Virginia.
When I finally give up on it, I guess it'll just die. I don't know. A lot of people in the Lions Club kind of worry about it. Some of them have even considered, you know, trying to run it on their own.
Jim has taught some apprentices over the years, but no one has stuck with it. When it comes to retirement, though, Jim isn't interested.
Well, you got to have something to do. I feel great every day. So I have to do something. If I wasn't here making brooms, I'd be maybe over at McDonald's making hamburgers or something. I mean, you need to keep yourself occupied and busy if you're able to. And thank goodness I've been able to pretty much all my life.
Jim says that the only downfall to his job is that he does get lonely.
Sometimes I'll go a week without somebody walking through the door. But it really doesn't bother me a whole lot, but I do enjoy company.
To pass the time while he works, Jim keeps his radio tuned to WQBE, Country and Western. And he's worn out a number of radios in his time on the job. There's at least three stacked in his workshop, covered with cobwebs and broom straw. But Jim always appreciates visitors. He'll even make a special broom for you, right on the spot. For Inside Appalachia and the West Virginia Folklife Program, I'm Emily Hilliard in Loudoundale, West Virginia.
Do the straw broom boogie. Well, you dance and you shuffle, you prance and you scuffle, you dance to the straw broom boogie.
We posted the video for this story on our website. That's at wvpublic.org. You can find more information there about Charleston Broom and Mop. Again, that's at wvpublic.org. And you can find more of Emily's work with the West Virginia Folklife Program, a project of the West Virginia Humanities Council, at wvfolklife.org. And one more update. Since this story originally aired back in March, Jim Schaefer says he's received calls and visitors from across the country. He says he's honored to receive all the attention, but he's having trouble keeping up with all the orders. According to Jim, he still hasn't heard from anyone who's shown any serious interest in becoming a broommaker's apprentice.
I'm gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom. I'm gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom.
As West Virginia and other parts of Central Appalachia face yet another economic downturn, how and why should we even care about supporting folklore or traditional arts and culture? Well, we asked folklorist Zoe Van Buren what she thinks about all this. She's a graduate student of folklore at the University of North Carolina.
Aside from whether or not the arts are actually your vocation or your place of employment, entire communities and towns and cities and counties need to invest in the sort of lived experience of their constituents. And I think that's what makes life flavorful, which might sound sort of frivolous when the immediate question is jobs, or the immediate question is housing or health or disaster relief. But I think it's part of every equation. It's part of every sort of dream about the future is not only where you work and where you live, but what will the quality of that be? Will it be good? Will it be healthy for you? Will you know your neighbors? Will you like where you are and have, an identity that you think feels acknowledged and respected?
And Van Buren points out arts and culture isn't just theater or listening to live music. It's the food we eat and cook for our family. It's the churches we attend. It's even the internet conversations and discussions we use to reconnect with old friends. Last summer, Van Buren traveled to Summers County, West Virginia, to record a series of oral histories and photographs about Jim Costa, a historian and collector of rare historic instruments. A few months ago, Costa and Van Buren both spoke about their work and played some traditional Appalachian music at the West Virginia Humanities Council headquarters in Charleston. The council's located at the 1836 McFarland Hubbard House, a landmark listed on the National Register of Historic Places and one of Charleston's seven antebellum houses. Roxy Todd was there to meet the two folklorists from different generations.
In a crowded room of about 60 people, Summers County native Jim Costa held a historic harmonica to his lips and played Civil War tunes, like this one. He also played songs on a banjo from the 1800s. Among his many achievements, Costa was in the film Mate One back in 1987. Over his lifetime, he's collected enough historic instruments, clocks, hatchets, and other tools to fill a small museum. 26-year-old folklorist Zoe Van Buren from the University of North Carolina spent her summer last year documenting Costa's legacy.
And I think that actually what he's accomplished is more than what a single museum can do.
Van Buren is a native of New York City. She says she's drawn to learning about the way people used to build buildings, cook food, and play music in years past.
Tradition is always about the next generation, not just about the last one. It doesn't mean just that from the past. It's the way that we interpret and use the past to guide us into the future.
One of the things that impressed her the most about Jim Costa was his skill at fixing old things, like clocks and instruments.
You can't hurt anything. It can always be repaired.
Costa kept his warm smile as somebody knocked one of his instruments to the ground by mistake.
I've loved you always, yes.
He finished the show with a love ballad that traveled to West Virginia from England hundreds of years ago.
Oh, darling, believe me, far over the sea, through life or death, oh, faithful I'll be. Yeah.
That was Jim Costa sharing his music and story with an audience at the West Virginia Humanities Council earlier this year. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from farmers and bakers who are reviving the Appalachian art of baking salt rising bread and making sweet sorghum molasses. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
And right here is a spot for another underwriter. We tend to think our listeners are the best listeners. We have thousands of them across the country, and our show airs on 11 stations across Central Appalachia. If you think you'd like to connect with our listeners by becoming an underwriter, you can reach out to Jane Wright with an email to feedback@wvpublic.org. And thanks. Have you ever heard of salt rising bread? Legend has it, this traditional Appalachian food, which uses no yeast, was created by pioneers in West Virginia who had very little ingredients. Bakers Susan Brown and Jenny Bardwell have been working to document the recipes and stories of salt rising bread over the past few years. They have a new book out called Recipes and Heartfelt Stories of a Nearly Lost Appalachian Tradition, and we'll get an update on that in just a few minutes. But we've kept an eye on these ladies for a couple years now, and from the Inside Appalachia Archives, Glynis Ford has this story about their quest to find the origins of this traditional Appalachian food.
Salt rising bread is an Appalachian traditional bread made without yeast. It's a baking custom that can be traced back to the 1800s, but not much has been documented about the bread or its history. So two women in Mount Morris, Pennsylvania, began a quest to understand the hows and whys behind a tradition that seems to captivate anyone who catches wind of it. Bakers Jenny Bardwell and Susan Brown have been researching the bread for 20 years.
We often describe salt rising bread as dense white bread with a fine crumb and a unique cheese-like flavor. Indeed, it is, when at its best, as if a delicately reared, unsweetened plain cake had had an affair with a Pont-l'Evêque cheese.
Susan Brown quotes James Furness, who describes salt rising bread in his book, The Americans.
So in other words, fancy combination of a fancy French cheese and a plain sweet cake, and you get that sweet cheese-like savory flavor of salt rising bread.
Brown grew up in Greenbrier County, where every Saturday she would have salt rising toast and eggs for breakfast with her grandmother. She's passionate about passing down the tradition. Brown's friend, Jenny Bardwell, was introduced to the custom through a neighbor, the recently deceased Pearl Haynes of Mount Morris, who made the bread for 90 years.
I'd go visit her, and they were making this bread that I'd never heard of, and it was a very unique bread. There's no yeast in it. So I immediately latched on to, this is special. I had never learned about anything like that in cooking school.
Bardwell is the owner of Rising Creek Bakery in Mount Morris. She and Brown opened the bakery about 5 years ago, and now it's one of the only places in the country that produces the product. Hundreds of loaves are shipped out each week. Through surveying their customers, Bardwell and Brown have discovered that by far, the favorite way to eat the bread is toasted with butter. Others like it dipped in sweet coffee or toasted with milk and brown sugar on top. The history of salt rising bread is something of a mystery. Passed down as an oral tradition, there are few records that hint at its origin. Brown and Bardwell have done some serious research, though. They've even traveled to bakeries abroad looking for connections. While it's difficult to draw any definite conclusions, their best guess is that the tradition was born of necessity in remote and isolated Appalachian regions in the late 1700s. Bardwell says the bread is a testament to the spirit of the female pioneer.
What we're finding out really is the ingenuity of pioneer women and how they persevered with their cooking. They were isolated. Appalachian women were isolated. They weren't able to get commercial yeast. It wasn't even produced till the 1860s, but they wanted a loaf of bread. So they kind of, anyway, they persevered with this very difficult bread to make.
We also believe that it's possible that these pioneer women would leave flour and water mixed together, like from maybe a gravy or the cream sauce that they were putting on something, and realized that if it was set overnight, it would bubble in the morning and their bread would rise from that.
That's baker Jenny Bardwell talking about how to make salt rising bread. She and Susan Brown told their story to West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glennis Board back in 2014. As we mentioned earlier, Susan and Jenny have a new book out called Recipes and Heartfelt Stories of a Nearly Lost Appalachian Tradition. Roxy Todd recently spoke with them about their new book.
Jenny, when we last heard from you, you talked a little bit about your bakery, Rising Creek Bakery, in Mount Morris, Pennsylvania, and you kind of started making salt rising bread there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, now I had learned how to make salt rising bread decades before the bakery. And from someone who was down the road from where we lived in Mount Morris, Pearl Haynes. Pearl Haynes made salt rising bread for almost 100 years. And she recently passed away, but she was able to share her knowledge with Susan and I. And we interviewed her. That's how I learned how to make salt rising bread. And it was just a pleasure learning all of the aspects of salt rising bread, the culture, the history, and some of the science that Pearl knew about.
And how did she describe it, or how did you know to ask her about it? Was it something you were kind of curious about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, salt rising bread, for me, part of the attraction is it's mysterious because it's made without yeast. And it's also a challenge to make because there's no commercial raising ingredient that you add. You have to create this starter. And I learned how to make the starter from Pearl Haynes, which was a cornmeal milk starter. And then through the years, Susan and I would go back and interview Pearl about salt rising bread because it's a challenge to make. It doesn't always work. And we'd go and ask her what we might have done wrong and what she knew about the history of it.
And Susan, you're from Greenbrier County, where salt rising bread has been passed down a little bit more than in other areas. Did you grow up in a family that had salt rising bread pretty often?
Yes, I did. My grandmother made it. I'm sitting here grinning because Jenny's heard this a million times, but one more time. My grandmother made it, as did her mother and her grandmother. And so I grew up eating grandmother's salt rising bread, and I loved it. And of course, I loved her. So I was determined to learn how to make it, to pass it on in my generation. And I'm hoping that my children are going to carry it on as well. But that was one of the really special things about writing that book, was that for me, part of the joy and purpose of writing it was to pay tribute to my grandmother, because if it weren't for her, I wouldn't know about salt rising bread, and I wouldn't appreciate how special it is and what a rich part of the heritage of West Virginia and Appalachia this bread is. Having written this book and dedicating it to her, as well as Jenny's friend Pearl, makes me feel really pleased, and like I've got something out there in the world that keeps her alive and honors her for who she was and what she did and all the things that she meant to me.
And did she pass away?
Yes. Yeah, she died in 1993.
So in some ways, this work sounds like a tribute to her and her memory, and you're keeping her memory alive through this food.
Yes, I feel that exactly.
And today, fast forward, in the modern realm, we can buy bread at the store, of course, but those of us who enjoy the smell of fresh bread in the oven, which is super rare for me in my life, but when I make myself do it, it's really satisfying. For someone who's never done homemade bread before, what is the appeal, I guess, in doing something so old-fashioned and that takes hours and hours of labor?
Because one of the things that happens when you bake something yourself and you serve it to your friends or your family, you start creating stories, because you say, oh, I love this bread. My mom always made it, and she would make it on certain occasions, or the cake or pie or whatever it was. And that's exactly what is one of the very rich things about salt rising bread, are all the stories that are so beautiful and so old and come from the heart of so many people who have eaten this bread. We have gotten endless stories from people who have these wonderful memories of the bread, who made it for them, how they ate it, and so on.
Do you have a favorite story to share?
Oh, yeah. One of the stories that we have is from a woman in California. Before the bakery was opened, she wrote to me on my website about salt rising bread and said that her mother really loved it and she wished that she could buy it somewhere, but she couldn't find anywhere to buy it. So she seemed like a nice person, and I said, well, I'll just make some and send it to you. So I did that, and she was very appreciative, and her mother really loved it. But her mother, over the next year or so, became very ill. And by this time, the bakery was open, and we had started sending her bread every month from the bakery. So for several months, we sent her the bread, and her mother would eat it, and she would always tell us how much it meant to her mother. And her mother became sicker and sicker until one day she wrote and she said, salt rising bread is the only thing our mother can now eat. And she was just saying how much that meant, that she could still eat at least the salt rising bread, which made us feel wonderful. And so we continued to send it. And just a few more months, her mother died. And she wrote to us and she said, our mother died last night. She can no longer eat your salt rising bread, but it was a comfort to me and my sisters. So that was a beautiful story.
A beautiful story indeed. That was Susan Brown and Jenny Bardwell speaking with Roxy Todd about their new book, Salt Rising Bread, Recipes and Heartfelt Stories of a Nearly Lost Appalachian Tradition. You can find a recipe and see photos from their book on our website at wvpublic.org. You might remember a previous episode of Inside Appalachia when we heard from two veterans who started producing sorghum syrup, a sweetener similar to molasses. The plant used to be widely grown throughout Appalachia and was used as a sugar substitute. Many use it the same way you'd use maple syrup. Here's how veteran and farmer Eric Grandin says he and his family use sorghum.
We use it in cooking mostly. The old timers, they like to put it over biscuits and butter, pancakes, anything that you could use maple syrup for, brown sugar. We love using it in baked beans, chili, spaghetti sauce. A lot of people, a quart may last them a week. They just eat it and eat it and eat it.
But if you don't know how to grow it yourself, I hear you may be hard-pressed to find locally made sorghum here in the Mountain State. So I was pretty excited when I found some sorghum for sale at a local store in Mercer County, West Virginia, just the other day. I've actually never had sorghum, and perhaps like you, I found myself wondering, what is sorghum anyway? Well, to find out, Roxy Todd sat down with WETS's Fred Sossman, Associate Professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City, Tennessee, who recently produced a film about sorghum.
As I was watching this film, I learned that there are many, many ways to eat and cook with sorghum. Here's Mark Gunther, a sorghum farmer down in Tennessee, describing how he likes to eat it.
Here in the South, most people use it on biscuits and cornbread. You know, they put a little butter with it and eat it with biscuits and cornbread. But I like it on pizza. I like it on chili. I like a tomato sandwich with it. We marinate steak with it.
And I'm here with Fred Sossman, the director of a documentary called Sunshine Makes It Sweeter. Fred, can you tell us a little bit about Mark Gunther's operation over there in Muddy Pond, Tennessee?
Yes, Mark's family is actually from Canada. His father grew up in Saskatchewan, Canada. And in Canada, he had actually never heard of sorghum syrup. The family moved to the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee in 1965 and started as a part of a very small operation, sort of a backyard operation, to make sorghum syrup. You can still, although Mark Gunther was born in Tennessee, you can hear those beautiful Canadian vowels in his voice and that beautiful Canadian accent. He lives with his family in a Mennonite community in Overton County, Tennessee, as I say, on the Cumberland Plateau. In about 1981, the Gunthers decided to really get serious about sorghum making, and now they're one of the largest producers in the country. They produce about 8,000 gallons of syrup every fall.
And a lot of our listeners might not be too familiar with the taste of sorghum. I'm actually pretty new to it myself. Here, let's play this bite by Ronnie Lundy. It's her describing what her mother used to say about sorghum growing up.
So if you had asked my mother what made sorghum better than honey, or what made sorghum better than maple syrup, or what made it better than just store-bought molasses, she would have said, it's got a wang to it. And a wang to it, I kind of think of that as being Appalachian umami.
Yeah, it's the fifth taste. It's spelled U-M-A-M-I. It's a Japanese word, loosely translated as pleasant, savory taste. And people often call it the fifth flavor, sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami. I've never used that word to describe sorghum, but I understand what Ronnie is talking about. Sorghum isn't just sweet. There are all kinds of layers of flavor in sorghum syrup, and as Ronnie points out in the film and in her book, the flavor of a particular syrup is dependent on a lot of things. The type of seed. There are dozens of varieties of sorghum cane seed, sweet sorghum seed.
It is a food that not only tastes of itself, but tastes of the place where it was grown. So that in different sorghum syrups, you get a sense of the earth where it's grown and the atmosphere, what grows around it. So most sorghum syrup has an undertone of something grassy because it is a grass, but it also tastes of the minerals. And I think that the minerals that it tastes of have to do with the ground that it's grown in. So that different sorghums from different regions have different subtle distinctions. They also vary from year to year.
Sorghum means a lot of things to me. When I eat sorghum syrup, typically the way I do it is straight out of the jar or bottle. Having done this film and having written about sorghum producers for several years, I taste labor and I taste knowledge. That may sound strange to say, but when I eat sorghum, I think about labor and I think about knowledge. that have gone into that product. Lazy people don't make sorghum syrup. This is a lot of work. It's a labor-intensive, almost year-long process from saving the seeds to planting the seeds in the spring to cultivating the seeds all summer long to cutting the cane and then boiling down the juice in the fall. It takes a long time, and it takes a lot of work. It also takes a lot of knowledge. The sorghum producers I've known, my goodness, they know something about mechanical engineering. They know something about electrical engineering. They know something about chemistry, about physics, about biology, and a whole lot about agriculture. So when I taste that spoonful of sorghum syrup, I'm not just tasting earthy, sweet, and floral. I'm tasting dignity and labor and hard work and intelligence. And sorghum making in Appalachia has always been a communal activity. It's always involved, like barn raisings, bringing people from the community together, each of whom has his or her particular role to play in the process, whether that's overseeing the boiling of the syrup or overseeing the chicken and dumpling dish that's served as a part of the meal.
Mark Gunther's wife, Sherry, talks about how they gather at the mill when it's time to produce the sorghum and the women all join. And let's listen to a clip real quick of her talking about that community event of making sorghum.
Whenever we make it at the mill here, we cannot leave to go eat. Nobody can leave. You got to stay there with it all day long. It's Mark's dad and his mom, and then there's three sons that are involved in making the sorghum. And all their wives, me included, will make about two dishes and bring to the mill, you know, to eat. And today I brought the chicken and dressing and broccoli salad. Me and my husband do, Mark, we do sorghum making demonstrations at different festivals. So we're really busy on the road doing that. And when we're home, we help here at the mill. And so it's just a constant going. If I'm home, I'm either cooking something to bring for the mill here, you know, for lunchtime, or I'm baking something that I take to the festivals that we go to.
And tell us a little bit about the history of, you know, the early sorghum farmers. And I think, you know, some of the early history of it being really a sense of resilience and independence in a way of Southern farmers being able to support their own family and their own farms without buying outside sweeteners like sugar.
Well, as Ronnie Lundy eloquently points out in this film, sorghum means independence, a way to make your own sweetening.
In mountain culture, in the Eastern mountain culture, there was a value for not being beholden to someone else. And there was a value on making things for yourself, growing things for yourself, as opposed to store-bought, going to buy something from the store or ending up in debt to somebody. Sorghum became something that you could plant yourself, you could grow it yourself, you could process it yourself. So it just became another part of that level of independence. Sorghum has that taste of independence to me.
And during periods in American history when sugar got very expensive, sorghum became the primary sweetener for a lot of families. It's a cane, interestingly, that didn't get into America to be grown until fairly late in our history. As we've pointed out, it is an African grass. Like a lot of foods we eat in the South and in Appalachia, it had its origins in Africa. Sorghum is an African grass that made its way ultimately into Western Europe and into the United States along about 1850, 1851. During the hard times of the Civil War, people relied on sorghum syrup as a sugar replacement. And now we know that although it does have a lot of sugar in it, sorghum is a healthy product. It has a lot of iron in it. In fact, in the 19th century, there were doctors who prescribed sorghum for iron deficient patients. It has a lot of phosphorus in it, so it's good for you. And one of the producers I work with here in Washington County, Tennessee, Arland Johnson and his wife Novella, their product is called Johnson's Sweet Sorghum. Their label describes it as Mother Nature in a jug. Not trying to practice medicine without a license, but if I were slightly iron deficient, I might start with a tablespoon or so of sorghum every day.
Fred, as you were traveling around and talking with all these sorghum farmers, some of what they said in the film is that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, there was not such a community of farmers growing sorghum. Why is this kind of a revival happening right now, do you think?
Well, I ask myself that question a lot. And I also ask myself the question, is this a dying art, a dying practice, or does it have a future? And I really think it has a future. And one of the factors that tells me so is the attendance at the National Sweet Sorghum Producers and Processors Association convention every year. We showed the film at the meeting back in February in Pigeon Forge, and the room was literally full of people, and they weren't all elderly people. There were younger people learning the craft of sorghum, particularly a group of students from Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville, not too far from the Muddy Pond operation, who were learning all about sorghum syrup. One of their professors is very active in the NSSPPA. So I think it has a future. It is, as I pointed out before, a lot of hard work. It's very labor intensive. But with the renewed interest in the foodways of Appalachia and the whole farm-to-table movement, sorghum syrup is a hot product. It's like so many of these other Appalachian foods that we've viewed as poor folks' food over the years. Things like ramps, red-eye gravy, now get catapulted into the national spotlight and find their place on the menus of what we call white tablecloth restaurants. So I think with people like John Fleer, of course, John has always known about sorghum syrup, but people like Edward Lee at 610 Magnolia in Louisville, people like Sean Brock, who owns Husk Restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee, with young folks like them who praise this product and who use this product in basic ways and in very creative ways, I'm convinced sorghum syrup has a future in America.
Fred Sossman's film is called Sunlight Makes It Sweeter, A Story of Sorghum. We've posted more information on our website at wvpublic.org. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. So we just heard that the Gunther family makes Muddy Pond sorghum in Muddy Pond, Tennessee. But just how the heck did the town get its name? Well, here's a few choices. Was it because a horse kicked over a barrel of sorghum into the water? Or was it named after a guy the locals called Muddy? Or was it because there's a pond there that stays muddy all the time? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia.
There was a man named Jack who stepped upon a crack. He was so thin he fell right in and he never did come back. Molasses, molasses, it flicky, sticky, go. Molasses, molasses.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. Well, it's not super complicated, and our friend Fred Sossman was happy to help us with the story behind how Muddy Pond, Tennessee, got its name.
This is what John Gunther told me. He said, long before his family moved to Overton County, Tennessee, someone dug a pond, and that pond never cleared up. It stayed muddy all the time, and that's the origin of the name. It's not a very large pond, but it's become a famous one.
Molasses, molasses, it's icky, sticky goo. Molasses,
so that's the story behind Muddy Pond, Tennessee, home of Muddy Pond sorghum syrup. If you know another story or ever heard of another town that you wondered, how the heck did they come up with that name? Send us a tweet at In Appalachia and we might explore it inside Appalachia.
Molasses, it's sticky, sticky goo. Molasses, molasses, it always sticks to you.
Can we learn something about survival from our ancestors? While working on this show, I yearned to talk with my grandmother just one more time. She taught me how to fight, to cook a few things, and we were always sewing, coloring, or painting something whenever I visited. But I wonder just how much I missed. While I didn't get to preserve all of my granny's traditional folklore, I'm thankful for the work to hold on to our stories. The more I discover about the history of Appalachia, the more I learn about myself. I take pride in knowing that I'm a part of a unique kind of resourceful, resilient, and smart people. As we move forward in these tough times, I hope we find happiness in what we have, but hold on to the determination to not only survive, but thrive in these hills. Our ancestors found ways to survive and sometimes even find joy in what they had. And I think we can too. How much do you value this kind of work? How many artists do you know with 401ks or health care? Do you think that even matters? Do you know someone with a traditional, almost forgotten art or craft? We'd love to hear your stories. Send us a tweet at InAppalachia or email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. And thanks. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the West Virginia Folklife Program at the West Virginia Humanities Council, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, and NPR's All Things Considered. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Dick Spain, Robert Johnson, Ben Townsend, Poddington Bear, and Teresa Brewer. And our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Patrick Stevens is our audio mixer. Suzanne Higgins edited our show this week. Roxy Todd helped to produce. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org and find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.